Welcome to the Adventure Audio Podcast. This is episode 161, and Laval is breaking down a very recent trip to Uganda where he climbed the highest peak in that country, which is a, I guess, side project is the best way that I could put it that he's had going on for a while now, which is to reach the highest summit in a large number of countries, which stemmed off of having done the seven summits, so the highest point of seven continents. Great conversation with Laval, as always. Really good to catch up with him, see him come back safely from another incredible adventure. He has a trip of a lifetime, about three or four times a year. So honored to be able to have him on the podcast as a co-host and get to hear about some of these adventures firsthand. It's really, really fun. So thank you, everybody, for listening. We also delve into some 2024 goals a little bit. We'll probably do a bigger episode around that very, very shortly. Also, Happy New Year. We're publishing this on New Year's Day. So wherever in the world this finds you, we hope that you're well, your family's well, and you're having a great holiday season. Happy New Year, and we hope you're going to have an epic and amazing and adventurous 2024.
Merry Christmas. It's been a long time.
It has.
I think we spoke just before I left for my second trip to Africa.
Yeah, you had two in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. You had two like once in a lifetime trips in the span of a couple of months. That's kind of par for the course for you though.
It was pretty good. Yeah. It was fortunate to be able to do this kind of stuff. And the second trip to the Rwenzori Mountains of Uganda, everything worked out just right. The weather was actually really good. It's notorious for its horrific weather. So we fluked out.
Awesome. Do you want to roll right into it?
Sure, but let's talk about our last podcast we did with Andrew Reed.
You got some
what
feedback.
A character. What a character, hey?
Awesome. Yeah, awesome. Like, I love having him.
Straight shooter.
Yeah, like I said, like one of my favorite follows on Instagram now, for sure.
Yeah.
I need a dose of that every once in a while, mm-hmm. Definitely, especially through the holidays too, when it's easy to take your foot off the gas a little bit.
How is that going? How is your fitness being maintained over the holidays? Are you happy with where you're at?
That might be a different podcast. Not really. Like I feel fit and strong, but I'm heavier than I would like to be, going into a season where I have a lot of hills that I want to climb on my bike, but you know, walking around, it's not a problematic amount of weight, but it's definitely not the leanest that I could be for cycling goals. So
are you saying that you're at a weight that you can actually walk? Well, that's good. You're good. You haven't gained up that much weight.
Yeah. So, that is a whole other podcast topic really, but it's probably something listeners would like us to dive into. Like, what do you find yourself in that spot and then what do you do about it? Because, you know, I'm definitely not perfect and I'm not my ideal sort of like racing weight, all of the time. I'm just not like, it doesn't seem to be completely achievable for me, or I'm not willing to make the degree of sacrifice where I'm at that level all the time, but I'm always about 2 months away from it. So I never let myself get far enough away that mm-hmm. I couldn't get it back to where I needed to be within about 60 days of warning, I would say.
So it's never completely unachievable.
No. And thankfully, knock wood, it hasn't been in my entire adult life. I've always been within a reasonable range. But I can definitely tell in pictures that it's like, oh, I was a little heavier there, or I look pretty lean. So it's it definitely ebbs and flows, and I'm a bit more of an ebb on the weight side right now for sure, which is all diet because I've definitely been putting in a ton of miles on Zwift and working out every day. Yeah, I've been getting after it. So I feel like the motor's there, but if you put me out on the road, I would definitely feel like I had a bit of a sail.
I think this time of year, though, I mean, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, this is when people tend to put on the weight. Not just because of Christmas, but because of the shortened daylight hours. You're outside less. I mean, here where we live, Pete, for our listeners, it's getting pretty much dark by 5 p.m. and it's not daylight till about just after 8 a.m. So we've got short days, and that I don't know if it's seasonal affectiveness disorder, but that lack of sunlight can really kind of destroy your will to go outside. It's tough for sure.
It would be interesting to do like a deep dive, and I'm sure people have done exactly that, but it just even on a personal level, it'd be interesting to do a deep dive on some of your metabolics and have some blood work done through the winter and stuff, because it's interesting. If I'm lean and I look really fit, I might be cardiovascularly about the same, but if I'm like lean, it's always in the summertime. But my activity level is it's pretty close for most of the year, with the exception of a couple of big peak weeks maybe in the summer. But they're not enough to like, lose like they're not enough to lose 7, 8, 9, 10 pounds. Like that's not the kind of difference that you see. But there's definitely something to that. There's something to shorter daylight hours, indoors more, and your metabolic rate. I'm sure that there is.
Yeah, and I've been lucky this fall, this Northern Hemisphere fall, because I spent just about a month in South Africa. Much of that was racing, and then came back, maintained my fitness, but then went for this trek and this climb in Uganda, which was definitely a good workout, and it was really good to get out there. So yeah, do you want to talk Uganda?
You're on the opposite end of it. Yeah, I do. I do.
Sure.
But I'd like to start. I was thinking about where to start this, and we've like brushed upon the topic a couple of times, but this is sort of like a life's project for you to see how many peaks you can get to and how many countries, right? So you're pretty
Yeah.
humble about these kinds of things, which is cool, and I appreciate that. But before we get into this journey, like this did check another box on a really large list of boxes that you can potentially do. And just like, when exactly did you start this, and when did you start to kind of keep track and think like, holy cow, I'm really starting to rack these up?
I didn't actually set off. I mean, I set off years ago to climb the seven summits, and then, like everybody else, I started off and I knocked off a few, and then had kids, and career was going taking me in this direction, and so there was a few years of a hiatus where I wasn't climbing as much. But one thing I like to do is whenever I go somewhere new, I find that you can really see the best part of either a state, a province, or a country. If you get into the high country, wherever that is, it doesn't have to be particularly high, but every country has a high point. One of the reasons I do it is because from now on, when I meet somebody from that country, I have that connection. I go, "Oh, you're from Hungary. I've run up the highest peak in Hungary," and then the conversation starts. And I really love that. I love making those connections, and I tend to find that making connections because of what you've done in somebody else's country, especially if you go into the remote regions of the country, really solidifies sort of a sense of respect for that region and for those people you're talking to. And then, so I started traveling, and I'd have meetings in Munich, and I was there a day early, so I jumped in a rental car, for example, and I would, drove to Slovenia and ran up the highest peak in Slovenia, Triglav, and I just take these opportunities to try and do that, or the highest mountain in Germany on a similar trip to Germany for meetings, the Zugspitze. And I started, sitting down one day, and I think I was with Jana, and she goes, "How many high points have you climbed?" And we started checking them off, and I was into the teens back then, but now I think I hit 30 on this recent trip. So I summited the highest peak in Uganda, Mount Stanley, and then we wrapped into or abseiled, depending on what part of the world you're from, into Congo, and we into the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and then we climbed Mount Albert in Congo. So really, just a really iconic part of the world. You're sitting there over the jungles of Congo, but you're wearing crampons and you're standing on ice and snow, and yeah, it's just Incredible. So, I mean, the list is not important, but just seeing these countries and getting these experiences is what I'm addicted to for sure.
That's awesome. Okay. So let's get into this one a little bit more specifically. So, but I can imagine how you can, when you have some other travel coming up in your life, whether that's personal, professional, or some other expedition that you want to go on, I can imagine how your mind immediately goes to, is there a peak around there that I could maybe make a little day trip to?
Well, it's
I
so
can,
much
I
so
can.
that Janet will even look that up. She'll say, "Hey, do you want to let's go to I don't know." She's a real wine expert, so she's got her WSET3 wine education, which is your Wine Spirit Educational Trust. So she really knows wine, like beyond anybody I've ever seen. And so when we go to a region, she has it all mapped out for what type of grape she wants to try and what type of wine she wants to try, etc. And then she'll also in her research say, "Oh, by the way, the highest peak in Slovakia is over here, and we're gonna have a rental car, so if you want to go one day and do that." I mean, that's which is fantastic. So it
What a
works out really
teammate.
well. Yeah,
That's
exactly.
fantastic.
Yep.
Okay, so you did this boomerang trip to Africa, so right back. And how did you get there this time? Same route.
No, so everybody's in the Western world just says Africa, and obviously Africa is a gigantic continent. You can actually see it sitting
Right
behind me
behind you.
here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it differs wildly and widely. So from Northern Africa, so north of the Sahara, you've got countries like Morocco and Egypt and Algeria and Tunisia and Libya, and those have almost no for us in the West, recognition with sub-Saharan Africa. And sub-Saharan Africa is the stuff that we think of with Tarzan and the Serengeti and herds of wildebeest, but we also have the jungles of Africa. And these are all different countries, obviously everything's different. So I just recently came back from South Africa, and now I was well north of that in sort of dead center in the continent of Africa in Uganda. Uganda's dead center, but it's considered being part of East Africa. So flew to Amsterdam on KLM down to Kigali, Rwanda into Entebbe. And Entebbe's a bit of an iconic airport in itself because this was, I believe it was in 1972. I'll have to check my dates, where there was a kidnapping, a hijacking of a flight that was of Israelis that was directed to Entebbe, and then the Israelis did a commando raid all the way from Israel down to Entebbe to free these hostages. And it's one of the most famous ever hijack or kidnapping rescues in history. And funny enough, years ago I was having lunch with an Israeli guy in the aviation business, and I was asking him what he flew when he was in the Israeli Defense Force, and he flew a or Israeli Air Force. He flew a C-130 Hercules. He was an older guy, and I said, "Oh, well, did you happen to be involved in Entebbe?" And he was actually a refueler there, so he circled a C-130 over Entebbe during the raid, and they were radio silence there, so they couldn't talk to each other. And what he was doing is listening to the BBC World Service on the radio inside the Hercules, the C-130. And he knew that if the BBC picked up the fact that there was a raid on Entebbe, that the fighter jets that were coming from Israel were going to come supersonic, have to refuel with him, attack Entebbe, refuel again, and then try and make it back to Israel. So he was there to back them up in case everything went wrong. And the plan was that the Israelis were going to wipe out the Entebbe airport if things went wrong. But instead, it went really right to the point where what's so fascinating about this raid is that the leader of Uganda at the time was a real despot, a sort of a real typical brutal dictator in Africa at the time named Idi Amin. And they found out what type of Mercedes-Benz he drove, found one in the suburbs of Tel Aviv. The Mossad, the Israelis did, stole it, loaded it up onto another C-130. They put a Ugandan flag on the whip aerial, put Dugan and license plates on it that matched Idi Amin's. And when they were able to land in Entebbe at night with no lights on to do this raid, and they drove around the airport in this replica of Idi Amin's Mercedes Benz. And because of that, nobody shot at them because they thought that was actually Idi Amin. And they pulled off this this raid.
Seriously.
Yeah, and they had to leave.
This is a whole other podcast.
He was telling me this at lunch. Yeah, and then they had to leave the Mercedes-Benz behind, obviously, to get out of there after rescuing these hostages. And then they did the right thing, and they went to the gentleman in Tel Aviv who they stole the Mercedes-Benz from, and they said, "We'd like to thank you for your service to your country, and we'd like to reimburse you for the cost of your, you know, 1972 black Mercedes-Benz, whatever model it was." And he said, "No, I want my car. I don't want the money. I want that car. That car is special." And they said, "Well, sir, it's in Uganda right now, and it's involved in this raid. We can't get it back from you. It's impossible." And he goes, and he was all pissed off and wanted the actual car back. He ended up taking the money, but it was just a fascinating story and an interesting connection for me to Entebbe. So there's a lot of history at Entebbe, so it's kind of interesting to go there. And one of the reasons that the Israelis were successful at this hostage rescue is that they had designed the airport in Entebbe, so they knew it so well they were able to land these aircraft at night without lights on the runway. So just an amazing story. Because I'm a pilot, I find it even more interesting. And,
of course.
So that's my long-winded way of saying I flew from Amsterdam to Entebbe. The guy I was climbing with, a Danish-Swedish combo named Anders Rodenberg, he was at the climate conference in Dubai. And so he flew from Dubai to Entebbe the next morning, met me there. And in order to get all his gear there, we didn't want to check any of our critical climbing gear because you just can't get it in Uganda. So he wore his mountaineering boots on the flight from Dubai to Entebbe with his business clothes on. It's kind of funny. So Anders arrived the next day. Everything was on time. All of our bags showed up, which was miraculous. And we loaded up in a Land Cruiser and did the 8 hour and 45 minute drive, the 390K it was, to into the mountains at a place called Kilembe. So we spent one night near Kilembe. And Kilembe is kind of an interesting area. It's a site of a former copper mine with some Canadian involvement. The company that started, I think, was called Frobisher Mines. It's been sold and handed over many times to different companies. But it was one of the biggest copper mines in Africa, located on this river that comes out of the Rwenzori Mountains. So you're in the rolling hills, green hills of Uganda, banana plantations everywhere, coffee growing and that type of thing. And then you see this very large range of mountains. In fact, the third highest mountain in Africa is Mount Stanley, the mountain that we climbed. And Kilembe is interesting because we got there and it was completely devastated. I can't remember the year, but just a couple of years ago, there were massive rains in the Rwenzori Mountains. All the debris that was being washed down the river dammed the river with landslides and rocks. And then, of course, that built up a massive lake behind it. And then when that burst, it burst above the town of Kilembe. This tsunami of rock, mud, and water came washing through the village and destroyed it. So you're driving through a village where the road has just been pushed through with a bulldozer through the boulders, and then there's houses cut in half, mining buildings hanging over into the river, and because of that, the area has been devastated both economically and environmentally by this flood. So that was, you know, a real eye opener, of course, to see the utter desperate poverty of the people living in Kilembe. So we started in Kilembe, the remains or the bones of this town. People, of course, are still there. And we met, you have to have guides and porters by law on this climb. So we met our guides and our porters. We set off that morning, not that early, it's probably around 9 a.m. It was hot. We were wearing shorts and trekking shoes, and we started the ascent into the Rwenzori Mountains, so into the jungle. And you go through all these different life zones, which is really interesting. So you start off in the rainforest. Well, I would call it rainforest, in the jungle. And in the jungle, it is exactly what you think. There's insects everywhere, and birds, and monkeys jumping overhead in the trees, which is pretty cool. And after day one, it was only about a 9.5K trek, and I think we gained maybe 1,000 meters of elevation. After day one, you're in a camp up there. The next day, you go through the bamboo zone. So this is fairly typical when you climb near the equator, as you go through the different life zones. So it's much like when I did Kilimanjaro. So you go through the jungle, that turns into a bamboo forest, which then fairly rapidly turns into a heather forest. And then the heather forest turns into what we would call the alpine zone here. They'd call the moorlands. And it's this swampy, high altitude swamp. Very swampy. We were in rubber boots continuously, other than the first 2 days of the trek.
At what elevation?
All the way up to 14,500 feet above sea level, you're in swamp.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, that's rubber boots.
When I saw your Instagram post about the boots and the mud, I assumed that that was like on some sort of low-lying approach.
No, the entire thing is mud. Like, I'm talking right to high camp, you're wearing rubber boots. So we wore trekking shoes for the first 2 days, and then we had to take off our trekking shoes and go to rubber boots. And you're in rubber boots right until you switch to your mountaineering boots. And it's a tough trek. When I did the trek into the highest mountain on all of Australasia, it's called Karstens Pyramid or Puncak Jaya down in Indonesia. Yep. That's notorious for having a very difficult approach as well. Jungle and roots and mud. And I'd say this is up there. I mean, pretty difficult scrambling at times in mud in rubber boots, like 60 to 70 degree slopes, but it's mud. And it's hard to explain because it's not like the mud is sticking to a 60 degree slope, but there are roots and rocks, and in between all those roots and rocks is mud, boot sucking Rowanzori mud. And in the morning it's got frost on it, and by the end of the day it's just regular mud. So it was really interesting to be up there at such a high altitude, relatively speaking, in mud. So pretty unique part of the world because of that. So for those of you who are going to go, the trekking company will supply boots for you. But what we did is we took the insoles out of our trekking shoes, our trail runners, and put them in the boots. And we actually had zero issues. We really kept good care of our feet. But my big concern was walking for days and days in that in those rubber boots and destroying your feet, but they're actually really good. They worked out really well.
Wow. Okay. And what about route selection? Is there more than one way up, or is there sort of an established route?
There's an established trail. There's a couple ways to get in there, but the route to the summit, there's only one route. It's the Margarita route. You go to the Margarita summit. So this mountain was first climbed in 1906, if I remember right, by a group of Italians. And they named that whole area after Italian nobility or royalty. So Margarita Peak is the name of the highest point on Mount Stanley. So it's a massive. And then the very highest point is called Margarita Peak. So yeah, you go from camp to camp. If you look at my Strava, the days are fairly short distance-wise. Like, we were coming into camp. He said that he said the top five fastest teams he's ever seen. And I don't think we were really pushing it either, but we were getting to camp and, 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it gets dark at six there. So there was a lot of downtime, but you're also acclimatizing because you're quickly getting up in elevation. The top of the peak is over 5,000 meters, and which is over 16,000 feet above sea level. I think just under 17,000 feet was the summit. So you do definitely have to acclimatize. In fact, on the way up there, when we were 2 days from this high camp, we encountered, one night I was out for a walk near the camp, and all of a sudden all these porters, these local Ugandan guys, like 15 of them, were walking towards me, heading into the up the mountain. I said, where are you guys going? And they said, we're going to do a rescue. So there was a German couple that was up there ahead of us. And this guy had been getting altitude sickness basically from one of the low camps on the mountain. And they kept pushing it, pushing it, pushing it, pushing it. And eventually he was in desperate need of a rescue. And he got to high camp and they had to carry him in a litter, a woven litter that it's pre-made, but it's made out of, you know, natural fibers, this litter. And they had to carry him down from Margarita Camp all the way to about 10K from the bottom, which was absolutely insanely rough country. I don't know how they did it, but they had probably 30 people. And he had such severe altitude sickness that we subsequently found out from a Swiss doctor who we bumped into, the only other climber we saw on the mountain was coming down, and he had run into this German couple. At that point, the German man was so sick from altitude sickness, he couldn't sleep on his back anymore, had to sleep sitting up because he had pulmonary edema fluid in his lungs. He had cerebral edema fluid on his brains, and he was non-responsive. So this guy happened to be carrying, because he's a doctor, he'd happened to be carrying dexamethasone, which is the last time I saw that in use was on people dying of altitude sickness on Everest. So he gave him a shot.
It's some sort of adrenaline?
It's a steroid. Okay. Some type of steroid, yeah. And he gave him a shot of dex. And to get out of the Rovensores, they're famous for having to climb up to get out to go down. So you're always going up and down, up and down. And at one point, they had to go up a pass to get this German guy down. And it's about a 500-meter elevation gain, which could be deadly when you're trying to get somebody down. And this Dr. Jonas from Switzerland luckily had just sort of stumbled upon this German couple and given him a shot of dex. And I bet you that's why the guy's still alive today. So very, very lucky that he ran into a Swiss doctor in the middle of nowhere.
You know what? Like, I'll get luxury. I'm not a mountaineer, but so many things can go wrong. You have to control the things that you can control. And one of them is if your body's giving you all these warning signs, like,
yeah,
you know, you need to have an A00 in your mission of getting back in one piece, at least, and control the things that you can control. You can't control an avalanche.
Yeah.
There's so many
unless
things
you don't know, unless you're so inexperienced that you don't understand what altitude sickness is and you don't understand the severity of it. So he got himself into, I think he was at the point of no return where I think he was on the way out if he hadn't run into the Swiss doctor and saved him. And actually, on an interesting side note, as we were chatting with this, we spent one night at the same camp as this young Swiss doctor. He was a big bike packer, Tajikistan, Gurkistan, all over Africa. He loves bike packing. So he'd done some big Central Asian trips. He just came back from Sierra Leone, which is not a safe place to go in Africa. And yeah, just, you know, this is what I love about these parts of the world is you meet these types of people, right? So anyways, yeah, the altitude can get you. It's not high. I mean, 5,000 meter peak is not that high at all when you consider that, you know, base camp at Everest is above that. But, you know, it's a fairly compressed timeline you're on. If you're coming from North America, you have, you know, really bad jet lag. And then you've got also the risk of picking up some type of illness while you're there, which is pretty common. In fact, a guy that ended up being on our climb, so there was two of us, but then we ended up picking up a third guy who, funny enough, had to be Canadian living in San Francisco. We sent him a message the other day just to say hi and Merry Christmas. And he had ended up in the hospital after the trip from some type of bug he picked up on the trip. So I was really lucky. I felt super healthy. And so did my climbing mate, Anders. So we were really lucky because when you're in the tropics, and your immune system's compromised every day because you're pushing it hard, you're not getting much sleep, and there's no such thing as jet lag. You just got to go. I think we're lucky. So yeah, you're up in this high altitude moorland, this high altitude mud, which is super interesting. Temperature ranges are quite significant, but you could easily get away with like a -5 degree sleeping bag up there, even though we were recommended to bring -18. I brought about a -5 degree bag. It was more than enough. But you still have your down jacket on every night. You sleep with your toque on, and it's surprisingly chilly up there at these, even though you're right near the equator. So long story short, after all these days of mud and with porters, by the way, so we only carried probably a 12 kilogram backpack each. So like a 40 liter or 35 liter backpack. But we had porters, which is a huge influx of cash into this economy, especially around Quilembe, where the copper mine is gone now. And I'm sure the Adventure Audio listeners are going to be happy to hear that both of our porters were females. So we had two very tough, small women carrying our bags. I didn't have a very big bag, but I was able to put some of it into Andrew's giant yellow North Face rucksack. So we're up there hiking in our technical clothing, our wicking layers, and our proper shoes with foot cream on them and blister protection and sunscreen, and we've got trekking poles and these roughy tufty adventurers from the West, and these gals are wearing jeans and rubber boots and no backpack. They just have a tump line across their forehead. And this is some of the most technical hiking terrain you've ever seen in your life. We're talking super steep descents in mud, super steep ascents in mud. You're going from log to log and root. You're slipping and sliding. And they would arrive at camp maximum an hour after us. Incredibly tough. So, yeah, it's just, once again, it's just a real eye-opener. And I saw that when I was in Indonesia climbing, where we had these Moni porters. So these Papuans live in the jungles of Indonesia, and they did that trek that I was on, no rubber boots. They did it in bare feet. So, yeah, it's just a whole nother level. So when you think you're tough and you're, taking some hero picture in the Rowenzori Mountains, and you realize that your bag is being carried by a woman, it's quite an eye opener. And it's a real testament to how tough people are.
No matter how crazy of a trip you go on, there's always some, humbling factor in it, it seems like, and I appreciate that you don't miss those.
Well, in fact, that trip in Indonesia, that incredibly difficult trek into the middle of nowhere in Indonesia, there was one of the mums, one of the female porters, carried her baby with her the entire way, and this kid's clothing consisted of sort of a torn t-shirt, and that's it. And it got cold at night. They would make a little shelter, like a lean-to, and burn a fire in the shelter. They would gather frogs at night and eat frogs. They'd go and raid birds' nests and eat the baby birds of the nest. These people were tough. So,
wow.
Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. So, it's not that heroic to climb in the Rowenzori Mountains and you've got the little ladies carrying your bags for you. And then they'd get to camp and they'd be doing tasks at camp immediately. They'd literally throw the bags down. And then all of a sudden they'd be running around like doing something, cleaning stuff or getting stuff organized for just incredible. So,
and yeah. And then, how about the trip down?
Same thing. Like they were able to almost keep up with us on the trip down. I think down is just as hard as the up because, you do a lot of elevation gain on the descent. So, yeah, we get to the high camp. It's up in the Alpine. It's beautiful, just stunning. It's called Margarita Camp. And then from there, you're in full mountaineering gear, just like you'd see here in Alberta. So we had crampons and ice axes and harnesses and we were ropes. We got to the summit just before daylight, just before sunrise. And it's notoriously bad for clouds and bad weather moving in there. When we talked to the German girl with the ailing boyfriend and the Swiss guy who'd been up there, they said they had like a couple of seconds of visibility and then the clouds rolled in. Well, we got up there and all the clouds are below us over the jungles of Uganda and the jungles of Congo were clear. And we had 6 hours of bright blue skies. It was unbelievable. Light winds. I mean, we just nailed it just by luck. So we got to the top and we'd already told our guide, Sam, that we wanted to climb Mount Albert, the highest mountain in the DRC. So we set up an abseil, dropped into Congo, and then we traversed across this sort of this cirque to the base of Mount Albert, which is a really steep, rocky snow and ice peak. And we climbed up these gullies up to the top of that and stood on the top. It was just amazing to stand up there in light winds, and the sun was shining. It was maybe, I don't know, -3 degrees. It was just perfect. And you're looking into the DRC, which is this fascinating, foreboding part of Africa to me, the darkest jungles of Africa down there. And you're standing on snow and ice. It's just amazing.
I can't even believe the stuff that you get up to. Even in the time that we've been doing this podcast, you've been on some crazy trips, and that's just like just a tiny little snapshot of some of the stuff you've done. We have a listener in Southern California who I got to know through his preparation for an Everesting attempt. His name's Steve. So shout out to Steve. And he texted me and he's like, "Where did you find this guy?" And I was like, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, pretty lucky to have him. I'm very lucky to be able to do this with you. And you're just, you're a content factory. So we always have something to talk about. So what's next? You must have something coming up. You always have something either booked or almost booked.
Nothing's booked at the moment, but I can say that I'm sniffing around fairly heavily at Taiwan right now, specifically Wuling Pass. So,
which is one of the 10 hardest climbs in the world.
10 hardest cycle climbs in the world. So I'm considering that. The best time to go is spring, so I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but there'll be something coming up here shortly. I want to get some
backcountry. I think a few of my Everesting podcast guests have done that, so maybe I can connect you if you want to get some intel.
You can also get a seat and fly over there with me right beside me on the flight to Taipei.
I don't know if I've got a trip to Taiwan in me this year, but we have talked pretty seriously about going to the Big Island of Hawaii in the fall. So that I'm
working hard.
Working hard to put the pieces in place for that. So, which is purportedly, according to PJAM's cycling. So if you haven't listened to our episode with John Johnson, you have to go listen to that one because that guy kicks ass. But it is purportedly the hardest road cycling climb on planet Earth and is arguably not even entirely a road cycling climb. Mm-hmm. So it's the Big Island of Hawaii, which is called Hawaii, is essentially comprised of two sections, which have two main volcanoes, and one is Mauna Kea, one is Mauna Loa. There's roads to the summits of both. I think that Mauna Loa is the 103rd hardest climb according to PJAMS and their methodology for ranking this, which is really, really cool that they do that. Like for nerds like me,
103rd.
I think it's the 103rd hardest. Wow. Yeah. And they're right next to each other. So there is a road that sort of traverses the island and sort of splits it into the two sections that's called the Saddle Road. And that's a good chunk of the elevation right there is climbing up that road from whether you're staying on the west or east side of the island, because you can approach it from either way. It's farther from the west, but I think there's a few more accommodations there. So I think it can be accomplished either way. But then once you get to off of that Saddle Road onto the road up to the proper climb to Mauna Kea, that's when it gets really, really real. There's also a great YouTube. There's a number of YouTube videos of people going up. Actually, not that many people have done it. I think it's it's a few hundred people probably that have done it according to Strava. John Johnson has a video of him getting up there, and it is brutal. And then I think there's about a 7 mile section of gravel. And it looks just steep, 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 and not really gravel, more like volcanic sand.
Yeah, I heard it's really slippery.
Yeah, so there's a lot of strategizing to do around what kind of bike to bring up there, because it sounds like even a gravel bike is kind of insufficient for getting up there. So you sort of accept that you're going to hike a bike, a section of it, or push. And if you have a support car with you, you might as well just switch into runners at that point, right?
But didn't you want to bring a mountain bike up there? So we'd ride up on our road or gravel bikes, then transition for the last 7 miles or 10K, whatever it was?
I think that's the way to do it. Because if we have a support car, which is strongly recommended because of the altitude and your ability to get back down quickly and safely if there's any issues, That's probably at the start of the gravel section, is to switch to mountain bikes, try and finish the ride from there. And you probably don't even switch back to the road bike once it goes back to road, because you're so metabolically compromised at that elevation that you're putting out, I think they say, a probably 60% of your available power, 40 to 60%. So like at 10, 11, 12, 13% grades, I might just as soon just stay on a mountain bike and go 7 kilometers an hour and just keep the wheels turning, to just barely eke up there. Like when you look at videos of people, like they're barely moving.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And these are people who I believe are very, very good at climbing on bikes. So, if you Google this, there's far more stories of people saying, well, I got to this point, or I got to that point, or I got to the saddle road. And so it's not a slam dunk. It looks absolutely horrific. So in total, I think you gain, what is it, like 4,000 meters? I think it's roughly 4,000 meters.
And it's rated as the toughest using the FEETS index, the FIETS index. It's rated as the toughest climb on earth.
So it's brutal in all kinds of ways. And it's about the hardest thing you can do on a bike in one shot. And then the longest road climb is Mauna Loa, which is right next to it. That's the longest continuous road climb that you can do on planet Earth. And they're right next to each other. That really seems like the kind of thing that I should get involved with.
If you're there.
That's kind of what I think. Mauna Loa does seem more civilized. It's a more reasonable gradient, but it's well over 100 miles of up miles, just one way. So it's huge, huge, huge long climb, but it looks like it's nice long ribbons of pavement through the lava field. So it looks absolutely mind blowing, scenery from both of them.
Mauna Kea first, across the saddle up to Mauna Loa, and then back down is what you're thinking?
If we think we can do it in one ride, we'd almost definitely need to be doing some riding in the dark. So it depends.
We could do it in one ride.
Or it's kind of cool two rides too, because if you do Mauna Loa in its own ride, then you've done the longest road climb.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because otherwise you start it partway up, but it's pretty epic to try and hit both in one ride. In which case, I would definitely think that would be the way to do it, is get up Kea, do that mountain bike section, get back down, get to a place where it's safe to descend, which might be descending on mountain bikes the entire way back to the saddle road. Because if you've got them, like, why not? You're not really, because it's so twisty, I don't think you're picking up a lot of time on the road bike. And it is insanely steep. Like, it sounds like people are concerned from a safety standpoint on the descent of Kea. But then, yes, you could get to the saddle road. And if you had sufficient time and daylight and support, if you've got support, you can do quite a bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
With meaning, support and lights.
We have to rope our wives into doing this with us.
Pretty much. Or, yeah, we're paying a local or a janitor, Christina, helping us out. So that's a very, very seriously looking at that. So you're thinking more cycling, a little more cycling, and you'll probably find a way to run up a couple of peaks this year too.
Oh yeah, I'm assuming. Yeah, no, I've got one sort of big trip planned, hopefully in the summertime, but I'll let you know about that offline. But it's in a sketchy part of the world. But yeah, I'm up for everything.
I know that you are. You actually mean that when people say that. You actually mean it.
This big island trip, but we're thinking October, November, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, which gives us a long runway of summer. I'm already trying to sketch out a couple of double century rides in the summer. So, like, you know, sun up, sun down type of bike rides. So, which I need. I need that stuff in my life. Yeah. So
on the cycling topic, what happened with the 4i giveaway, the power meter company that we've teamed up with?
That's how I was going to wrap it up. So, huge thank you to everybody who wrote in and gave us answers to those questions. We've got tons of messages on Instagram, tons of emails. It was actually a really fun way to just hear from listeners, because they didn't just usually provide the answer, but maybe they gave us some context about how long they've been listening or what, right? So some people have heard from some people who've been listening for a really long time, from like way back with Tyler. And then some people who had followed you and found the podcast. Some people who had listened to the Everesting podcast that gave this want to listen. So very, very cool to hear from everybody. We have selected winners. I just used a random generator. So I'm just waiting to hear back from 4i right now on how to best get that distributed. So we'll announce the winners very, very soon, and we'll contact you all individually. But it was super fun to do, very fun to hear from everybody. And we're looking forward to hopefully collaborating with 4i more in 2024 and doing more with them and having them involved, maybe even with this big climb in Hawaii.
Yeah, that'd be great to see what kind of power we're putting out, and plus have heart rate monitors on. And
would it be great though?
Concerning?
Yes.
Concerning, yeah. You know, it's before we get going, we were talking about something I wanted to talk about when I was trekking through the mud of the Rorenzoris, and I was, you know, thinking about the podcast and stuff to talk about the podcast. I love this concept. Have you heard about this, Pete? Mountain training units?
No.
So mountain training units, MTUs. So 100 meters of elevation gain, 1 kilometer of horizontal gain. Each is one mountain training unit. So what you do is you can go online. And you can type in, so like on the first day of this climb, it was 9.5 kilometers, and we did 1,148 meters of elevation gain. So what you do is you put this into the calculator, and it gives you the equivalent in effort in MTUs. So a 9.5K hike is nothing, right? Obviously. I mean, that's just a walk around the park. But when you gain 1,148 meters, it gives you an equivalent flat kilometers of 20.98 kilometers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. And the reason I brought this up is when we were in the Rorenzoris, and you're not only climbing up, you're not only getting your MTUs in, but I was thinking about RTUs, so Rorenzori training units, because you're in the mud. And I was like, you should add another 25% in effort onto that just because of that, because you're slipping backwards, you're falling down, you know, your boots are getting, you know, pulled off your feet in the boot sucking mud. But I love that concept of mountain training units, and how there's never been a way to sort of describe, you know, a 10K run in the mountains compared to, you know, people, oh, that's not very far. Well, it depends. If you've gained 2000 meters of elevation, now you're talking, you know, you're pushing a marathon type distance or more. So take a moment, our listeners, and look up MTUs, mountain training units, and then take your last run in the mountains and plug in the distance and the elevation. It'll give you the equivalent in MTUs. And I think it's about right, because a 9.5K hike, as you know, is nothing, but a 9.5K hike and 1,200 meters of elevation gain in the mountains is a different beast. So it was fun. It was fun thinking about what... You know, I spent hours going, what would be a Rorenzori training unit? Would it be 25% more, 50% more? So it was kind of fun.
Well, it's funny. The first thing I always think about is, well, how long would it take? Right. Mm-hmm. And I break it down from there. Right. So if I think about like an Ironman versus an Everest thing, like, well, how long would it take? So I immediately think that the longer thing is, that's harder. It's usually harder, right? If your heart rate and your output is close to the same, it's usually mm-hmm. harder. So, and that's a way to calibrate it, right? Because how long did your 9.5K trek take?
I'd have to look on Strava, but I can tell you right now if you have a second. But so, yeah, that's a good way to look at it. So 9.5K, I said it comes out to 21K is what I said. So let's take a look here.
Because it would probably usually take you, what, 3.5 to 4 hours to walk 21K, right?
Yeah, that's about right. So here we go. It was, so day one was actually 10.4K at 1,600 meters of elevation gain. So it was bigger than what it's described in the guidebook. So 3 hours and 3 minutes.
Yeah. So the math kind of is, it's in the realm, right? That's actually really fast though, to do 1,600 meters.
10K, 1,611 meters. 26 kilometers equivalent. Yep.
Yeah. I guess. So, oh, no. Still, that's because you... Geez. Oof. I don't know. It might be even more.
But it's interesting how your perceived effort... I mean, we talked about this before on the podcast, perceived effort. And so down low on the mountain like that, I think there'll be a straight mountain training unit until you get into the mud. There's no mud at that point. But once you get in the mud, it's a whole different world. Like, it's a completely different world. So it's fun to think about that.
Well, you've just sent a bunch of our nerdier listeners down a rabbit hole to figure this data out. All right, man. Well, it's awesome to catch up. Let's get something out early in the new year to everybody too. We'll get this thing kicked off right, and we're going to do a whole bunch, and we're going to do some adventuring and training, and hopefully a ton of podcasting in 2024.
Let's try and get a winter road bike ride in.
In.
Okay. Sounds good.
We'll talk offline.
Happy All right, buddy. New Year.
Okay. You too, man.
Thanks we'll everybody for listening. Yep. See ya.
Thank you again, everybody, for listening and spending some of your valuable time with us on the podcast. As we always tell you, the best way to help us grow the podcast is simply by word of mouth. So letting somebody know that in your circle that might enjoy what we're doing here on the show. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll be back very soon with a guest. And again, happy 2024, everybody.